Hey guys, welcome back to our weekly podcast. Before we get into this week's session on wisdom, I'd like to tell you about a few things coming up for the men at Morningstar. So the first is our August 8th breakfast. Starts at 8 a.m. in the East West Cafe right at Morningstar. And very low-key event. It's more like a social, a mixer. We'll do a little bit of teaching. The theme for the morning will be keeping the team together. And it's a great time either to come out for the first time to see a little bit about what we do on Saturday mornings, or maybe to get reconnected with some guys that you don't see that often. And as always, I'd encourage you to invite a friend if you've got somebody from work or maybe a next-door neighbor. This is really a non-threatening event. Anyone can feel comfortable sharing a meal with somebody else, having a little bit of conversation about some important things that every man deals with. And so I'd like to invite you out to that. The next thing is our September the 18th men's ministry kickoff for the fall season. That will be on a Friday evening. We're going to start off with a meal, and then we're going to do an overview of the topic for our fall series, which is entitled What Every Father Needs to Know. And then following that Friday evening kickoff event, we're going to do 6 weeks as a church-wide event for men. We'll meet it a couple of times a week at the church, and then, of course, there's going to be some home groups or some groups that will meet at a diner. We're not quite sure about all the details. It's going to be 6 weeks on the topics that every dad needs to know, every dad needs to have as his own arsenal of information that he wants to share with his children. So I'm looking forward to this being a great series, and I want to invite you to think, even right now, even at the end of July, you think about being part of that. All right, so let's get into this week's series on wisdom, and it's entitled, Why is Wisdom So Difficult to Acquire, and Why Does It Take So Long to Get? So the first question, a why question, why is wisdom so difficult to acquire? And you might be thinking, well, I don't know that it is. Next question, why does it take so long? Okay, so we have a few new faces, so let's do just the slightest bit of review. Wisdom, anybody? Good operating definition? The one that we've been using? Okay.
Making good choices?
The ability to make the best possible choice in any situation. Now, that doesn't mean it's the perfect choice, but given the information that you have, the knowledge that you have, the understandings that you have, to be able to make the best possible choice in any circumstance. All right, we've said that there's a couple of things that challenge us in that, and part of this is the answer to this question, because who are the types of the people that Proverbs describe? We said there are four basic types of people that the Proverbs describe.
Simple, foolish, wise, and wicked.
Holy cow, just like that. Look at that, gentleman, there is hope. One man remembers, and he did it excellently, too. Why don't you sit at the front more often? Maybe this is the key. Okay, so what's the simple person? He doesn't know when he doesn't know that he doesn't know. And so he's oblivious to the fact that there is information out there. So when the simple person goes into something, he doesn't know what he might need to know. He's naive about it. It might be another way of saying it. And so he charges headlong into it. What's the next category of people? That's the foolish person. And what's the foolish person?
Know-it-all.
Okay, the know-it-all. You mean sort of like you this morning that has all the answers? The foolish person is the person who's, as we might say, wise in his own eyes. It's not that he's not smart. He might be the brightest person in the room. He might actually possess the most information, the most understanding of anyone in the room. His weakness is he thinks that that's all he needs. So if assembled in this room, and remember one of the other foundational points that we said, that none of us has all of the wisdom we need for all areas of life, that every one of us should acknowledge that we're on a constant pursuit of a journey toward increased wisdom, but that doesn't mean that we're not wise about something. So assembled in this room, even amongst this small group of people, is a large body of not only information, but also understanding and wisdom. Now, what if you're the smartest person in the room? What's the likelihood that you're going to take information from someone whom you perceive to be less knowledgeable and wise? It's minimal, right? And yet, according to our understanding, that person may possess the single key piece of wisdom that you need in order to make a better decision. But because, here's the manifestation of the foolish person. He's a proud person. He has enough information, he needs nothing from anyone else. Okay, then we said there's the wise person. That needs no further explanation. We've already defined that. The person who's best able to make a good decision in almost every circumstance. And then there's the final category of people, the
wicked.
Yes, what's the wicked? And this is deceptive because we say, you'll see why it's deceptive in a moment.
Someone who will make a bad choice, even though it'll harm himself or others.
Yes. The wicked person is not, as we might often imagine, this heinous person that's... I mean, just picture the person that you would best categorize stereotypically. Thank you. Wicked person. We said that a wicked person instead is a person who knows that the consequences of action, his actions may inflict harm on someone else. He doesn't care. And he's going to do it anyway. Okay, so that's our information so far. That's some of the review. And here's the challenging part. Which one are you? Okay, give someone else a chance, okay? Yes, that all four of them are bound up in us. And we have to be careful about that. Okay, so back to this big question. Why is good wisdom so difficult to acquire? Why does it take so long to get it? And again, we can almost say that this is cliche. The idea that who is the wisest person in the room? Typically, who do we think? If you were to draw cartoon characters and one were to represent the least wise and one were to represent the most wise in cartoon form, what would the most wise person look like? Of course, he would have gray hair and a long beard, right? Well, what's symbolic about that? At least according to ancient wisdom literature, why is that so symbolic?
They've been around.
He's been around, and what is that there for?
They've been able to gather more information than a younger person.
Okay, so they've... And...
life experience.
They've gathered up more life experience, but here's the ultimate test. Were they able to live long enough in order to get gray hair? We don't think of living as much of a challenge today. But if you go back thousands of years, it was a big deal to live long enough to get gray hair. All right. So a couple of facts that serve as background for this, before we get into this. How many of us do you think crave more wisdom, more understanding? Can you think of right now a decision that you're trying to make? I mean, apart from, let's say, whether you're going to have a block party today or not. Can you think of decisions apart from that that you might need wisdom for? Right, so every one of us is craving additional information. Now, here's the amazing thing. Back when the Proverbs were written, how much useful knowledge was available to a typical person? Let's take a typical peasant out there on the, we'll say, the farm. And how much information did he have available to him on a regular basis? Should I sow this crop or that crop? Should I sow this week or next week? Should I go up to this town? Should I go to that town? Should I move my family here? Should I move my family there? And yet he made most of those decisions with how much information?
Not much.
Not much at all. Most of us have more information in our fingertips at any given second of the day than this person had access to in his entire lifetime. Take a look at some of these stats here, and they're on your paper. There's more information available to the average person in the U.S. today in one day than was available to a man in Solomon's day during his entire life. And yet we still crave more information. Now, why do we do that? We have all of this, and yet have you ever wanted more? Have you ever wanted to just get one more piece of information to help you make that? Why?
Yeah.
To be absolutely sure, and because we want it personalized to our situation. We're not quite sure if the information that applied to Joe applies to me if I'm Jim, and so I'd like it to be a little bit more personalized. Now just think for a moment what that displays. Great insecurity and a complete lack of trust in God's ability to guide us. That's one possibility. All right. Because it's out there, we feel compelled to sample it. Now, have you ever been tempted to do a Google search, to go get more information, just because it's there? You've already made up your mind, but what could it hurt? I may as well see. Have you ever noticed that sometimes more information makes you more confused than less? This is staggering. Every day, millions of us seek out answers to almost every imaginable topic. So I don't know how long I've been talking. Well, I can tell you. I've been talking for... Well, no, I can't. I've been talking for a couple of minutes here. Look at this. 40,000 Google searches per second. Per second. That means in the time it takes me to say per second around the globe, 40,000 searches. What is it here? 3.3 billion? And here's the most amazing thing. Approximately 15%, and this is according to Google people, approximately 15% of searches that are made are about something new that Google has not yet gotten a specific search for. In other words, if you've ever started to type in a query in Google and it starts to give you that prompt, right? That means that it's already been searched. Have you ever run out of the prompt? That means that specific search in that order with those words has never been done before. Otherwise, it would continue to prompt. How many of you would think it seems reasonable to believe that given this much information, we'd have to be able to make wise choices, right? Yeah. The world should really work very well because given the fact that we have so much information at our fingertips that should help us to make the best possible decisions, the world should run like a finely tuned Swiss watch. Is that your experience?
No.
Okay. So we need to get back to a couple of these things, some of which we've already talked about. What are the four kinds of people that live within me? Besides him, he already knows.
Foolish, wicked, wise.
Simple. Okay, all four of those are bound up in us, and therefore every time we make a decision, we make it based on everything that is inside of us. Here's a question for you. Why do you work? Now this is a very important question. Why do you go to work? Why do you do what you do? Okay, provide for family. Anybody else? Who said that? I assume you consider yourself to be part of the family and therefore providing for you is also part of providing for your family. Okay. Anybody else? Help me understand what you mean there. Okay, stay occupied. All right, anybody else? Be productive in society. Give me a shorter way to say that.
Whatever just you're producing.
It useful?
Be a benefit.
Okay. Good collection of answers. I've phrased it a different way. Let's see if we can identify these from the list that I'm going to give you, see if we can pinpoint where these fall. The first one is to keep the life we already have. We work in part to keep the life we already have. Anybody see a match there? What would be some of those? Yeah, exactly. You already have a family, you already have yourself, and you would like to keep them both in working order. So you work in order to keep what you already have. The next one is to get what you want. Are there things in life that you don't yet have? Things that you'd like to have. Goals that you have for the future. So we work, number one, to keep what we have. Number two, to get the things in life that we want. And the third is to jettison or to get rid of the things that we don't want. All right? So how many of you own a house? In how many cases is it true that both you and the bank sort of own the house together? Okay. And so therefore, one of the things that you're working toward is what? to get rid of some of the things that you don't want, namely your shared ownership with the bank. You would like the house to be all yours and not only partially yours. All right? So those big three themes are predominantly why we work. To keep what we have, to gain the things that we believe we would want, and then to get rid of the things that we don't want. Anybody see some conflict coming up here? Potential problem? So where do you suppose, or what do you suppose, we seek to gain wisdom for then?
Discerning between the common goal and family and personal goals.
Okay, so that's, in general, why would we seek wisdom?
To do a better job.
Of all three of them, right? How do I keep the things I have? How do I get the things I want? Which would be the best things in my life to get rid of? And so we, generally speaking, seek wisdom in all three of those categories. Does anybody see some tension arising? I seek wisdom, and remember, this is the day-to-day condition that we find ourselves in. I seek wisdom about how to, do you want to keep your family good? Do you want to keep them, do you want to keep your family together? Do you want to get, yes, that's a good goal. And so you're seeking wisdom for how to do that. You're also seeking wisdom for how to gain the things that you believe will be helpful to you and beneficial to you. And you're seeking wisdom for how best to get rid of the things that you think may now be an encumbrance and be holding you back. What's the challenge there? Okay, so suppose somebody, remember, keep, we'll just abbreviate it this, keep, get, keep getting loose. If somebody gives me wisdom that contradicts my aspirations in any one of those areas, how likely am I going to be to listen to it? I'm going to dismiss it. Now, this is critical. You and I all have these essential three objectives in mind every morning from the time we wake up to the time we go to bed. To keep in good working order what we have, to get what we don't have that we believe we want, and to lose those things or get rid of those things are an encumbrance to us. And therefore, we seek out wisdom. And remember how much is available to us. We seek out wisdom that is going to help us to do this. But what happens when the wisdom that we get contradicts what we want? Of course, because we can only choose so much wisdom. Has it ever been your experience that certain wisdom contradicts other wisdom? Have you ever heard contradicting things? Of course. I was just sharing with you the other week that the common wisdom today, some of the common wisdom today about relationships is it's moved from should a person live with somebody else before they're married to this is just generally accepted practice, and it helps you to understand the best techniques and strategies to use when selecting someone to live with and how long you should live with them and the ways that you should live with them and how to manage that relationship while you're living with them in the hopes that perhaps if it turns out to be the right circumstance and situation, you might want to get married in the future. Well, now, if you're exploring that and you're saying, I wonder if I should get the situation to live with someone, and somebody's giving you all the information that you need to do that, are you even going to consider the information from someone who says, I'd think carefully about that before I did it? Now, that's a low-hanging fruit example. I want us to all think deeply. This is not about theory. This is about your personal life. Is there anything that you are striving for, that you are seeking wisdom for, that in the end, there might be one small voice that you have heard that says, be careful, maybe that's not the best choice, but you're intent on getting this. What's the advice that we always get about big goals and striving for them? Is it just try a little and it should come to you easily? What is it?
I work at it.
And how hard?
Very hard.
Throw all who you are, all of your time, all of your energy into this big goal, and if you do that, you might get it. Can you see the tension that's building there? If I'm pursuing something with all my heart, all my soul, all my mind, if I am pursuing that, and it's not actually the wise thing to get, am I ever going to listen to wisdom that says maybe you shouldn't do that? Maybe you've heard this definition of stubbornness, and that someone defines stubbornness that's good as having pursued and persisted and then been proven right. Have you ever been stubborn and been proven wrong? So the only admirable kind of stubbornness, according to that saying, is the kind of stubbornness that after you've achieved what you set out to achieve, it proved to be a good goal. But have you ever stubbornly, steadfastly pursued something, and in the end, you got exactly what you asked for, and now you don't want to keep it? Or, and it's written somewhere in your paper, but some men are excellent at getting the girl. And then they don't know what to do with the girl once they have her. They're not sure that they want the catch that they've gotten once they've gotten it. And so sometimes we get stuff and only later do we find it's not what we wanted. Okay, now this is really nice theory to talk about. Is there something in your life personally that you've been working on? And maybe you're not going to want it once you get it. Or maybe the things that you're going to have to do to get it are going to turn you into someone who won't be fit to hold it. Let's turn over to 1 Kings 22. I'll wait a moment until you get there. All right, now this is one of these kind of weird but interesting stories. So I'll read a little bit in chapter 22, and then I'm going to work backwards so that we see the players here. For 3 years, Syria and Israel continued without war. So this is a divided kingdom. Israel to the north. Syria occupies a border to the east with her. And so he said, for 3 years, Syria and Israel continued without war. But in the third, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, the southern kingdom, comes down to the king of Israel. And why it says came down, I have no idea. And the king of Israel said to his servants, do you know that Ramoth-Gilead belongs to us? And we keep quiet and do not take it out of the hands of the king of Syria. So in other words, there's this, we'll call it provincial town, out toward the outskirts of the land. And the town is actually, this Ramoth-Gilead, actually belongs to Israel, but it's in the control of the Syrians. Now, what does that mean? It means that all the prosperity of that city is going to the Syrians. If there is any taxation that's done, it's going to the Syrians. All the good livestock and the fruit and all that, everything good that comes as the result of the work of the people of Ramoth-Gilead is going to the Syrians. It's not going to the king of Israel. Just, we've tolerated that long enough. Now, why do you suppose he's tolerated it? Because on his own, he's not strong enough to take it back, right? If your neighbor had something that was yours, and you really needed it, and you could see that they were gaining a lot of benefits from it, and you could just walk right over there and take it back, would you tolerate that? Am I talking too fast for you all? I mean, you're not understanding this, or what? No, of course not. You would just walk across the lawn, climb over the fence, do whatever was necessary. You'd go take your thing back, and it would be yours again. Because after all, whose was it to begin with? It was yours. So there has to be a reason why they're letting that city, that region, in the possession of the Syrians. Okay, so now we're going to back up, and we're going to delve into more weirdness before we get to the new weirdness. So, the old weirdness. We're going to turn back to chapter 21. We're all familiar with the story, but it's helpful if we read it. I'll try to read it quickly. Now, Naboth, the Jezreelite, had a vineyard in Jezreel beside the palace of Ahab, the king of Samaria. And after this, Ahab said to Naboth, give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden. Okay, so you get the picture. So here's Naboth, has this little piece of property. It's right next door to the king's house. The king looks out his window every day. He sees a nice piece of property. The king wants to raise some fresh fruit and vegetables, and he says, that would be the ideal place to do that. And so he walks next door, and he says to Naboth, hey, how about you sell me that? Or we'll trade it, it'll work out some deal. And listen, I want to be fair. I want this to work out for both of us. So if you don't want an even trade, if you don't want to sell it to me because you feel it's your father's property, that's fine. We'll just trade. Whatever you want, you tell me. Let me see. And if it seems good to you, I will give you its value in money. But Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. So what's his answer? No, that's the one word answer. No, right? He is a diplomat about it, right? He's gracious about it. He says, listen, this is why I don't want to give this to you. And Ahab went to his house, vexed and sullen, because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him. For he said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And he lay down on his bed and turned away his face and would not eat food. So what do we call that? Huh?
Pouting.
Pouting, yes. So he's moved into full-blown pouting. All right. So which of the three are we working on here?
Get.
Yes, we're working on the get. So Ahab has a goal. He wants to get this thing. There's something standing in his way. He doesn't get it. Now, up to this point, no one has done anything wrong. Naboth has a desire. The desire is for a legitimate reason. I'd like to be able to raise some nice vegetables over here. Seems good. Would you share that land with me? Would you give that land to me? And the answer is no, and here's why this is no. And incidentally, that would have been a very common answer. Land was passed down generation to generation. The Israelites really didn't own the land. They were simply the stewards of it over a period of time. But Jezebel, remember that name, his wife came to him and said to him, "Why is your spirit so vexed that you eat no food?" And he said to her, "Because I spoke with Naboth the Jezreelite," and he said to him, Give me your vineyard for money, or else, if it please you, I will give you another vineyard for it." And he answered, "I will not give you my vineyard." And Jezebel's wife said to him, "Do you now govern Israel?" What's the question?
Mm-hmm. Who's in charge
here? Who's in charge here? Well, we're going to see who's in charge here in just a few seconds. "Do you now govern Israel? Arise and eat bread and let your heart be cheerful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth, the Jezreelite." Now that's an interesting statement. How can she give it to him? Does she own it? How many different types of people are bound up in this?
Wicked.
Yeah, I know, four. Somebody else? How many different types of people? I want this to be embedded in us. The foolish?
Wicked.
The wicked? The wise?
Simple.
And the simple. All right. At this moment, so you get the picture, and if these were actors on a stage, they would each go their separate way. I don't know. Maybe Ahab would continue to lie on his bed with his face turned toward the wall and pout or something like that. But Jezebel leaves the stage. Which type of person is Ahab right now? Why? Does he ask Jezebel, "How would that be possible? What could you do that I couldn't?" No. He knows she is going to get her way. So what's the definition of the wicked person? Anybody? A person who gets what they want or seeks to get what they want, knowing the consequences will fall on someone, but doesn't care about the consequences that will fall on someone else. So at that moment, how does Ahab want to be perceived? How is he telling? Who is he telling himself he is?
Oh, he's smart.
Or he's simple. I don't know. How could that happen? I have no idea how my wife could get this. My wife must work miracles or something. Now, they've been married. We assume they've been married for more than a day. We assume that when the wife confronts Ahab in this manner, that they have been married for more than a day. And so Ahab wants to believe that he doesn't know and doesn't know that he doesn't know, and yet does he know? Deep down inside, he kind of knows. He might not know the specifics, but he knows how. And so she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal. And she sent the letters to the elders and the leaders who lived with Naboth in his city. And she wrote the letters, "Proclaim a fast and set Naboth at the head of the people." And then set two worthless men opposite him and let them bring a charge against him, saying, "You have cursed God and the king." Okay, so here's the strategy. We're going to call this great festival together. We're going to place Naboth in a prominent position there. And then at the most favorable moment, we're going to have two scoundrels come in. And they're going to cast charges against Naboth. Why two? She's a very cunning lady. Why two? Because in Old Testament law, it took the witness of two people in order to guarantee that something was true. So she even uses the law of Israel to her advantage at this point. Make sure it's two. Make sure the stories are just the slightest bit different so it seems believable, but yet the content of the stories is essentially the same. And what happens in the end? In the end, Naboth is killed. Then they sent to Jezebel saying, "Naboth has been stoned, he is dead." All this for a vegetable garden, right? Meanwhile, back at the house, Ahab is, we don't know. As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, "Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money. For Naboth is not alive, but dead." And as soon as Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab arose to go out to the vineyard of Naboth, the Jezreelite, and take possession of it. Now, if you were Naboth, what would you ask? What would you say? You just heard that your next door neighbor was dead. What would you say? Boy, that's a shame. I mean, even if it was fake, boy, that's kind of sad. Really, how did that? Oh my word, I had no idea. How did that happen? What does Ahab do? He's like a little kid. Woohoo! I got what I wanted after all. And he goes out to, we assume, plant squash and asparagus. I don't know, whatever they would have grown. And then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Arise and go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, who is in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has taken possession. And you shall say to him, thus says the Lord, have you killed and also taken possession?" And so it took one man to confront Ahab with what he had done, even though he hadn't done it. Because here's what we have to assume. Ahab could have said, "You know what, it's okay. We can plant our vegetables somewhere else." But he chose not to. "And you shall say to him, thus says the Lord, in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick up your own blood." Okay, so they don't prophesy quite the same way today as they did then. So we don't talk about dying in the middle of the street and having the dogs lick up your blood. Or at least not in civilized countries, we don't. But it's an interesting way to get somebody's attention. "And Ahab said to Elijah, have you found me, O my enemy? And he answered, I have found you because you sold yourself to do what is evil in the sight of the Lord." Now, it's interesting what Ahab's response is. What is it again? "Have you found me, O my enemy?" What does that imply? Not only that he's done wrong, it seems that there's history here. In other words, if we were to read a little bit into the story, we'd have to conclude that this is not the first exchange between them, and we'd have to conclude that in past exchanges, the voice of wisdom that the prophet tried to speak into Ahab's life, Ahab didn't like. Remember what we've said. Three things. Keep what we have that we want. Get the things that we want that we don't have. Lose the things that we don't want. And we seek wisdom in that direction. Do you see this all playing out here? Okay, so now, with that as a backdrop, we move into chapter 22. "For 3 years, Syria and Israel continued without war. But in the third year, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel. And the king of Israel said to the servants, do you know that Ramoth-Gilead belongs to us, and we keep quiet and do not take it out of the hands of the king of Assyria, or of Syria? And he said to Jehoshaphat, will you go with me to battle at Ramoth-Gilead?" Now, these two kings should be representatives of, we'll call them, sister kingdoms, although the southern kingdom was often told not to associate with the northern kingdom because there was such a distinct level, differentiation in the level of wickedness. So if the southern king was a little wicked at times, the northern kingdom was significantly wicked most of the times. Here's the way it's described. Move up to 21, verse 25. "There was none who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of the Lord like Ahab, whom Jezebel, his wife, incited. He acted very abominably in going after idols as the Amorites had done, and whom the Lord cast out before the people of Israel." Now, what would you assume would be the consequences of ruling that way? Is everybody awake here? Here's the interesting thing. By secular historians and by those who judge government just based on the successful outcomes of government, Ahab was an incredibly successful leader. He increased the wealth of his country. He increased the territorial holdings of his country. He fortified places and cities and was, by political terms, one of the best leaders that they had. In other words, if you were to measure the success of the leader based on the financial prosperity of the inhabitants of the kingdom and the security of the kingdom, He was one of the best leaders there. And yet, how did God judge him? Because he pursued, was his goal to have a vegetable garden bad? He pursued the things that he wanted in any way possible to get them. And this is the small and subtle danger for all of us who are in get mode. And so they're sitting there together. This is kind of like a big deal, this meeting that they're having together. They're sitting there together. This is perhaps the first time in a number of years where a northern king and a southern king have come together and have a meeting. And this is a prolonged meeting. He's staying there for a while. And so Jehoshaphat says, here's his answer to Ahab when Ahab asks him if he'll go to battle. I am as you are, my people as your people, and my horses as your horses. In other words, he says, after this long break we'd say that there's a new treaty been signed now. A new treaty between these two countries, and the leaders have agreed to an accord, and they will work together. And so Jehoshaphat just put a seal on that. He only has one condition before they go to war. And he says, and Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, inquire first for the word of the Lord. Then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said to them, shall I go to battle against Ramoth-Gilead, or shall I refrain? And they said, go up, for the Lord will give in to the hand of the king. There's a couple of interesting facts here that I want you to look at. How many prophets are there?
400.
Have you ever heard a straight answer from 400 people that was the same answer? Have you ever heard an answer from 3 people and it was the same answer? What do you think is happening when 400 people come into the room as the king's advisor and they all have the same message? What's that?
They're saying what they think the king wants.
And why do you think they're saying that? Their job depends on it, right? Maybe their neck depends on it. In other words, they're saying to the king exactly what the king wants to hear. All right. What's that?
They're keeping their job.
Yeah. Big question. Time for a pause. When you and I are on a mission to get the thing in life that we want, does wisdom that helps us get that, does it go down sweet and nice? Does the one final thing that we want in order to help us get the thing that we desperately want, does that feel so good to get it? Because how do you think Ahab felt in that moment? Let's not make him some mystical figure from the past. Let's make him any one of us. Because remember who lives inside of us besides the simple and the fool and the wise? The wicked. What happens when we get the last piece of information that will help us to get what we want? And yet there's that still small voice that says, watch it. Remember the 3 types of wisdom we talked about? Wisdom has 3 messages for us. What's the first? Do this. There's an entire, it's not in your notes. It's review, which means that apart from our new guests for the day who are exempt from this part of the teaching, apart from them, all of you should readily be able to pull this answer out of your memory. The 3 messages of wisdom. The first is do these things. What's the next message? Don't do these things, but the largest body of information that wisdom has to speak about is the third. And what is that? Right. It says, there is opportunity here, but be careful, be wise, be prudent, because there could be danger here as well as opportunity. All right. So we'll return to the 400 prophets and Ahab, all rejoicing. But Jehoshaphat said, is there not here another prophet of the Lord of whom we may inquire? Now that's an interesting thing. There's already 400 prophets in the room. What difference could 401 make? So what's Jehoshaphat sensing right at that moment?
Could be a problem.
There could be a problem. These guys are just too much in agreement. They don't even seem to put the slightest restraint on what Ahab wants. When you and I desperately want what we want, how much restraint do we want on us? Have you ever cast off restraint to get what you want? I heard something this week that's really relevant to what we're talking about right now. A good friend lifts us up. That means when we're down, when we're beat down, when we're heading in the right direction, but the difficulties of life are just wearing away at us, a good friend lifts us up and encourages us. But there was a second piece of advice, and it said, a good friend also knows how to hold us down. When we're after the things that the good friend knows are bad for us, a good friend would actually almost throw himself onto us and pull us to the ground to prevent us from getting the bad thing that we think is the good thing that we want. So a good friend lifts us up, but a good friend also holds us down. And what's Jehoshaphat looking for in this room is one person that might offer some counter wisdom. One person that actually sounds as if they're not working for the king, but actually working for the Lord. Because who did Ahab call into the room? Who did Jehoshaphat ask for? A voice from the Lord. Is there someone who represents the Lord here? One of the marks of experience is you'll be able to discern the voice of the Lord from the voice of the crowd. Now, if you were to describe the two, how do you suppose that the two would be different? The voice of the Lord and the voice of the crowd.
You just know it when you hear it. You know it
when you hear it. Okay? For those of us who might not know it yet, how would you describe that? And I'm being serious, because to tell someone you'll just know it when you hear it might almost be the same as how do you know when you found true love? You know, and if you were watching the Hallmark Channel and one of the characters would say to the other, well, you'll just know it when you feel it. Sorry, but, well, am I wrong?
No, not at all. It comes with a complete sense of conviction if you don't do it.
Ah, so there is conviction present when you choose to stray from it and when you walk in it? There's a sense of joy and a sense of peace. So those would be some guiding indicators. Now, are you sensitive to that when you're in get mode? Let's just be honest. Think of the thing that you've most wanted in your life. Are you sensitive to the voices, the small voices? Because the one thing that I was going to say is the voice of wisdom from the crowd is usually loud. The voice of wisdom from God is usually quiet. It's rarely loud. It's rarely obnoxious. Okay, so Jehoshaphat said, is there here another prophet of the Lord of whom we may inquire? And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, well, there is this one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, Micaiah the son of Amiah, but I hate him, for he never prophesies good concerning me, but always evil. Okay, so you see the relationship that they've established so far. So in Ahab's mind, what is the voice of the Lord going to always be?
And so
when we get the voice that comes from God, if it's not going to help us get what we want, what do we with it? We stuff it down, we ignore it, we move on, and what do we say? It's trying to hold me back from my dreams. Remember this third part, the lose part. How many of us in life spend a lot of time trying to lose the things we've already gotten? Because once we get them, we find out they don't fit with who we are and what we really wanted in life. Matter of fact, some of us might be holding on to something like that right now. And here's the bad news. Some things in life you will never lose, because once you get them, you can't give them back. There's a no refund policy, and they're yours for life. And so you better choose carefully what you aspire toward, because once you get it, you might be stuck with it for a very long time. Oh, and you're laughing because what?
I'm keeping it in my head.
All right, so where are we?
Verse 9.
Okay, well, we're going to go to verse 10. Now the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, were sitting on their thrones, arrayed in their robes, at the threshing floor, at the entrance to the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets were prophesying before them. So, do you see the splendor of this scene? So there are, in presence, 402 people, plus attendants. Let's not forget the attendants. They're all those people who bring the king's, I don't know, coffee or wine or whatever the king's want at that given moment. There's all these other people that are bowing down and being servile and pretending to honor the kings there. So there's this mass crowd. Jump down to 13. And the messenger who went to summon Micaiah said to him, "Behold, the words of the prophets with one accord are favorable to the king. Let your words be like the words of one of them and speak favorably." Okay, so what's the instruction? When you show up to be the prophet of the Lord, here's what I want you to say. But Micaiah said, "As the Lord lives, what the Lord says to me, I will speak." Now he must have thought better of this, because it says, "And when he came to the king said to him, 'Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we refrain?' And he answered him, 'Go up and triumph. The Lord will give it into the hands of the king.' But the king said to him, 'How many times shall I make you swear that you speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?'" Now who is that said for? Sit for the benefit of Jehoshaphat. In other words, he's playing to Jehoshaphat. He's saying, "Now, when you know that we have this arrangement, good prophet, that whenever you come to me, you always speak in the name of the Lord. Now, is that the arrangement they have? What's he just called the guys who spoke in the name of the Lord? 'My enemy, you scoundrel, you rotten bum, you've come to ruin my life and destroy my dream.'" And so let's see if we can jump down to the really gory good part. Let's see. And Micaiah said, "Therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the king sitting on his throne and all the hosts of heaven standing beside him on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, 'Who will entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead?' And one said one thing and another said another. And then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord saying, 'I will entice him.' And the Lord said to him, 'By what means?' And he said, 'I will go out and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets.' And he said, 'You are to entice him, and you shall succeed. Go out and do so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit into the mouth of all of your prophets. The Lord has declared disaster for you.'" So that's his pronouncement. These 400 guys are liars, and the Lord has pronounced disaster on you. All right, what kind of courage does it take to be the 401st person in the room who contradicts all 400 others? Now, what do you suppose happened to him? Did he get a nice pat on the back, a bag of gold to go home with? Nice job. Let's talk again tomorrow? No, of course not. And it says, and we don't have time to read all this, but it says that he was basically kept on house arrest with the minimalist of food that would keep him alive. And here's what it said. And this is what Ahab said. He said, essentially, "You're going to be on house arrest until I get back. And when you get back and you see that I have won, then you will know that you don't speak for the Lord." And the prophet says back to him, "If in fact you do get back, then you'll know that I don't speak for the Lord." And so he stays there. Now, I don't think we are privy to find out what happens, because Ahab doesn't return from the battle. So we have to assume that at some point in time, somebody released the guy from house arrest. But anyway, that's enough of that. Now, here's my point. Do you really suppose that you and I are that much different than Ahab? I mean, I know we don't necessarily want a vegetable garden next door, and we're probably not married to Jezebel. Or at least I hope you're not married to Jezebel this morning. If you are, then this may be a category that you find your wife in. But we're not so very much different in a lot of small ways.
What was the definition of the simple?
The simple is the person who doesn't know, but doesn't know that they don't know. And so, for instance, in the book of Proverbs, you'll see the simple man wandering up the street, it describes, of the adulteress, or the loose woman, or maybe the harlot, or whatever. And the simple man doesn't know that there's danger there. In other words, he walks right up the street and walks right into her house because he's not aware that the direction that he is pursuing is ultimately going to lead him to very bad things. He's very naive. So most of our kids start out simple. I mean, I know it seems as if they're intentionally wicked, but really they're not. They're just simple. They don't know, and they don't know that they don't know, and therefore they draw conclusions based on the fact that they don't know and don't know that they don't know. So there's a very important set of questions that we need to ask, and let's leave them up there. Here's one of the big questions. Will I want to keep what I get once I get it? Will I know how to enjoy what I get once I get it? Here's another one. Will what I get fit into the life that I am called to live? Because remember, we've said that all wisdom is relevant to purpose. And so therefore, wisdom that is applicable to you in a very specific sense may not be applicable to me because you and I have different purposes. How many of you like to buck trends? How many of you like to be the only person in the room? In other words, how many of you would like to be the 401st prophet? How comfortable does that feel? And so most of us follow crowd mentality. We follow herd mentality. If everybody else wants this, we assume this is a good goal and we go after it. Have you ever followed crowd mentality to get something that you thought you would want because the rest of the crowd wanted it? And if the rest of the crowd wanted it, obviously it had to be a good thing. And you just didn't quite yet understand why it was a good thing. And so you pursued it just like the rest of the crowd. Did anything that I said make sense? Because I'm looking at blank faces right now. We need to know that we're going to be comfortable with what we get and does it fit? There's an illustration that I used here, and it seems almost childish. Suppose that you were a cardboard box. And suppose that as a cardboard box, you aspired to be a swimming pool. And so you got the help of all of your friends, and they filled you up with water because you could then be a swimming pool. What would happen in the end?
Collapse.
You'd be destroyed. You would be destroyed as the result of getting exactly what you wanted. Now, I know that's a simple illustration, but the purpose to it was to make it so obvious that sometimes there are things that we pursue that we want so badly, and in the end, they are going to destroy us. It's just that we are too simple yet to know it. And the simpleness that is bound up in us prevents us from seeing that. And so when God comes to us and brings us wisdom and says, I don't think you want that. Let's hold back. Because here's the other part of the message. You need to become the person that is fit for the thing that you want to get, because even if you got a good thing and you got it at the wrong time, you would not be the right person to hold the good thing, and in the end, you would either destroy it or it would destroy you.
You can directly relate that to like buying a home. Like some people want to, because our culture, because everyone else does it, you just buy a home and you buy something too big for you, but if you're not fit for you, if you don't have the right job to support it, it can all crumble. You can lose it. You're bankrupt.
Okay. Let me see where we are here. Okay, well, we can read this next part together. The person most in trouble is the one who is confident that he knows what he should know, that he knows should know, and also he knows that he is pursuing the best things, and all the while he is operating without a critical piece of knowledge or understanding. This is going to tie directly into a story that I'm going to tell you in a minute. That one assumption allows him and even compels him to push ahead confident in the knowledge that giving his all is the best course of action, and it will most likely gain for him the best results. So I want to tell you a couple of stories quickly. I heard them this week. They're going to sound as if they were scripted to be cheesy Christian testimonies, but they're not. And they really do. They sound exactly as if they are cheesy before and after testimonies, but they're not this at all because they're not even intended with a spiritual purpose. So the first one is an interview with one of the key figures in Live Nation. Is anybody familiar with Live Nation? They organize music events, they do concerts, they get behind all this stuff, and there is significant money involved in it. And this guy is retelling part of his story. And one of the questions is, so you started out life here, and I'll tell you where here is in a moment. How did you get to there? That's got to be a phenomenal story. And the here is, he says he remembers many nights trying to go to sleep, and he heard his mom in the next door, in the next room, in their small trailer in the South, just sobbing because she didn't have enough money to take care of things like property taxes or the next light bill or whatever it is. And he says, I remember going to sleep many nights with that same basic message. There wasn't enough money to pay the bills. And we were living this way because we couldn't pay the bills. And not being able to pay the bills, in other words, not having enough money in life, was a miserable state of affairs, and I would never wish that on anyone. And so now we fast forward. And the guy says, and so a number of years later, he says, I'm sitting there. I'm sitting there in a room by myself at night. And remember, by this time, he is a key figure in Live Nation. Money is flowing. There is an abundance of money. And he says, I'm sitting there and I'm on the brink of crying and I'm wondering how it is that at the end of my second marriage, and trying to figure out how I could possibly be a father, a single father to a couple of kids. And he says, I'm just blown away by this simple question that had never occurred to me before. Now keep in mind, this guy is smart enough to be instrumental in building this important business. And he says, how could a person who has gotten everything that he wanted in life be so joyless and have his life in so many pieces? And the power of this is not, and didn't I warn you, it would sound like the start of a cheesy Christian testimony. But the power in this is that we can be blinded by the one thing that we want to get, and we don't understand that there's something good that we need to keep while we chase after we want to get. And if I abandon what I already have to get what I want to get, it is possible that in the end that I am going to be just as unhappy, just as discontent, just as miserable. And I've also inflicted harm on the things that I said I wanted to keep. Do you understand what I'm saying? And we should never, ever delude ourselves into thinking that we're above that, that we're too smart for that. Some of the smartest people in the world fall for this. And it doesn't have to look like that. Is there something that you said that you wanted, that you value? So let's think back and let's roll the tape back all the way to the trailer park. What was in the trailer park? What was in that little modular home that was good? That he didn't see at the time.
He has a mom.
He has a mom. He has a mom who is staying in the fight no matter what, who won't leave just because it's tough. A mom who loves him enough to fight and stay there and try to pay the bills for the sake of the kids. But when you're 7, do you notice that? No, you don't. You don't notice the good thing that you already had there because you're surrounded by the one bad thing. And so the one thing that you want to get, which is enough money to pay for everything that you want in life, clouds all of your judgment about everything else that you already have. And so this is the next question. Is there something about what you want to get that is clouding your judgment about what you already have? Let me tell you the second story. So the second story is not quite as depressing. The second story is about a guy who he's got some physical impairments. And he had a choice to make. Is he going to let the physical impairments hold him down, or is he going to move on beyond them? And so he uses these physical impairments, these limitations, as a springboard. He lets them motivate him on to accomplishing some great things. And in the process of this, he hears from person after person the question, how do you do this? And so he decides to become a personal life coach. And he says, he's coached many people successfully, and he's done this very well for a number of years. And he too reaches a crisis point in his life. He looks back at where he's come from. He looks at who he is. He looks at the number of people he's helped. And he has a different dilemma. He says this, how could the person who's helped everybody else to get the things that they felt that they wanted, how could that person not have an answer for how to go to the next phase in his own life and be stuck in that in the present phase in his own life? And so he asks this question, and he asks this question in a more general sense to the audience that's listening to him. And he says, what do you do when you're the guy who's supposed to have all the answers and you don't have an answer for your own life? How hard is it to admit that you're the person who has an answer for everybody else, but you don't have an answer for your own life? What's the mentality there? Let's look at that. What's his identity? What's that? Yes, it is. I am the person who has the answers. What would it do to his identity if he had to go to somebody else to receive life coaching? Or, I mean, it could be that way, right? If he frames it that way, that you either have it all or you have nothing.
Or he's failing.
Yeah, right.
No, if he goes to somebody else, he's got wisdom.
Yeah, but does he see that yet?
Well, he may not, and I'll give you a perfect example. Les Brown, one of the guys that I listen to all the time, he has a coach, and he's the most successful speaker, and he gets paid $250,000 for 1 hour in Europe, but he has a coach, because sometimes he has barriers. I just listened the other day. He's got barriers. He's got a coach that helps him out. When I heard that, I was absolutely amazed, but that's wisdom. He knows that he's got to go to somebody else.
How much does that coach pay?
Absolutely. Yeah.
You looking for a new job after today, John?
So he's showing some wisdom. He knows that he's hit the wall. So he knows enough to go to somebody else and say, "Hey, I need some help." Everybody needs help.
Everybody does need help, but when you're young and you're insecure, you don't recognize that,
no,
do you?
No.
And the danger that we all face is that we build ourselves into a prison of our own making where we don't then reach out for help. And so you can either start to develop that practice when you're young, or you gradually build up this prison of never being able to ask for help. All right. You know, I planned this to be quick and to the point, and I think I've accomplished most of what I wanted. I want to turn over to Proverbs 2. John, do we have any decisions yet about what we're doing?
They're out there starting. Did the rain let up?
So it was raining?
It was raining hard for a while.
Now
it's barely, so they're starting to set up right now.
Okay. All right, so we'll turn over to Proverbs.
It's not going to rain again until it's all set up and going. So.
Proverbs 2, we're going to start at the beginning. My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commands with you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding, yes, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. Now that's an interesting twist. So I want you to look for a moment at verse 5, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. Would you expect verse 5 to be the culmination of your efforts in verses 1 through 4? Read it again for yourself. Would you expect verse 5 to be what you would find, we'll say, at the end of the rainbow of your pursuit of verses 1 through 4? And I want you to notice something else here. My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commands with you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding. There is a difference between wisdom going to us and we going to wisdom. Why do we go to wisdom? For this. And therefore my search for wisdom is oriented around this. But when wisdom comes to me, in other words, when I just sit at the feet of wisdom, if you will, when I am willing to learn from wisdom apart from an agenda behind getting the wisdom, then wisdom has an influence on me and what I will want. When I don't let wisdom have an influence on me and refine what I want, then I go to wisdom only after when I have determined what I want and I hope to take advantage of wisdom or hijack wisdom in order to get what I want. So instead of wisdom blessing me, I try to game or take advantage of wisdom. Have we ever done that? I know what I want in life now. Now God help me to get it. And please understand, none of us is above this. Don't think, I'm not above this. Believe me, I'm not above this. Matter of fact, I'm probably down somewhere. If there is a down, I'm under the down. Right? I am. And what I find, and frankly what I found this week, and I had a lot of driving to do. I left Wednesday morning to go to Indiana, and I was back last night. So there's a lot of driving in that time. And I had a lot of time to think about this. Here's where I am some days. Some days I can talk a great line. I can teach a great lesson. But I still struggle with this stuff myself. And there's times when I got to remind myself, you know, actually, here's what I found myself wanting this week. I found myself wanting to just say, you know what? I'd like to just sit in God's presence for a while without having to have something wise to say to somebody else. Wouldn't it be good?
Yeah.
I'm sure you felt that at times too. Wouldn't it be good to not have to have something smart to say to somebody else because I'm not sure I'm so smart on the inside?
Amen.
Well, you didn't need to say amen right then. Yeah, just keeping it real here for me, right?
Your first question to us, Glenn, was why is wisdom so difficult to acquire? And the answer of my heart is because it requires us submitting to God as the ultimate wisdom, not our experiences, not the things that we think we know. The other verse, that, I don't know where it is, Proverbs somewhere, but it says, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. When we get to a point where we're just done trying our way and really stepping back into what is God's wisdom, it looks a whole lot different than ours.
Sure.
Maybe let's just wrap up with this one verse.
We're willing maybe to hear something that we don't want to hear.
Let's turn over to this verse in 2 Timothy and we're going to wrap up with this. And you might feel that I am taking it a little bit out of context, but I really don't think that I am when you look at it in the broadest of applications. So we're at 2 Timothy, we're at the 4th chapter. We'll start at the first verse. I charge you, this is Paul talking to Timothy, I charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by His appearing in His kingdom, preach the word, be ready in season and out of season, reprove, rebuke, and exhort. And this is interesting, with complete patience. That's a hard one to do. To do all these things, and when I talk to you, when I see you, well, I'm singling you out. So that means you probably won't come back for another, what's it been, 6 weeks since your last visit or something? So I'll see you again in 6 weeks. But when I single you out and I focus my attention on you and then you don't respond, what do I feel like doing? Would you like to do that? Okay. Now, would that be wise?
For me, yeah, for him.
Well, with patience means that I'm going to do it without expectation. I'm going to keep doing it. Not because in the end, if you follow my leadership, it makes me look wise, but because I want the best for you. And even if you continue to stray, I'm going to keep coming back and investing in your life out of love. So it's easy to do these things, any of these things, reprove, rebuke, and exhort. It's not so easy to do them with complete patience. And here's the verse that I wanted to get to. For the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own passions and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander off into myths. What's he saying there? And how does that apply to what we've talked about this morning?
He's talking about all people are always looking for something new, like all the different religions that keep popping up, like you have Scientology or Jehovah's Witness. All these people are looking for something different than the wisdom that we've already had for years and years and years.
They're listening to the 400 instead of the one.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on?
And so, how do I want to say this? I guess in the end, it's easier to surround yourself with people who will tell you what you want to hear than it is to sit in the presence of someone who wants to, as your friend, hold you down. Because none of us by nature wants to be held down. Until we're beaten down, we don't want to be held down. And so the challenge, and this is why patience is essential, the challenge is to modify the character without breaking the spirit. If you break the spirit, you can hold anything down. But God wants the spirit left alive and the character modified. And so I think I'll leave us with that. And with an understanding that every one of us tends to want the 400 around us and not the one.